morning, President Trump had a 28-point peace plan for Ukraine. Europeans agreed with one: Russia should not completely take over the country. Now the plan is changing, so where do negotiations stand? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Israel has killed more than 300 Palestinians after declaring a ceasefire with Hamas. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It also agreed to a ceasefire in Lebanon almost a year ago and has launched attacks almost every day since. Also, the Phantom of the Opera gets remixed into immersive theater, where the Phantom might be standing next to you, and how decorating for the holidays can put us all in a better mood. It is Monday, November 24th. On this day in 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, explaining his theory of evolution. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. American and Ukrainian negotiators say they've made some progress toward an agreement that would end the war in Ukraine. Officials met on Sunday to discuss a U.S.-authored peace proposal, a plan some European allies say leans too heavily toward Moscow. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports the Trump administration called the talks productive but offered few specifics.
A joint statement released by the White House said that U.S. and Ukraine officials met in Geneva, Switzerland. Together, the two countries called the discussions, quote, constructive, focused, and respectful. The 28-point plan was written without significant input from Ukraine or its European allies. It calls for Ukraine to give up some territory to Russia, shrink its military, and would block Ukraine from joining NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky responded to the plan last week in a video address, saying his country faces a choice between losing its dignity or losing the U.S. as a key international partner. In response to a reporter's question, Trump said this weekend that this plan is not his, quote, final offer to Ukraine. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The president of Brazil is expressing concern over the U.S. military buildup near Venezuela. Kate Bartlett reports President Lula da Silva says he plans to raise the issue directly with President Trump.
Da Silva, who was speaking on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Johannesburg, said there was no reason to have a war. He warned against repeating the mistake of what happened between Russia and Ukraine and said, quote, once a shot is fired, it is hard to predict how it will end. The U.S. has conducted more than 20 strikes on vessels in the Caribbean and Pacific, it says were drug boats, killing dozens of people. The U.S. has also sent an aircraft carrier strike group, Navy warships, and stealth aircraft to the area near Venezuela. Trump accuses Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro of leading a terrorist drug cartel. Kate Bartlett, NPR News, Johannesburg.
The Federal Aviation Administration says this will be the busiest Thanksgiving travel period in 15 years, with more than 360,000 flights scheduled. The TSA expects to screen nearly 18 million passengers over the holiday. Rico Walker, a TSA officer for 20 years, says he and his colleagues are prepared.
Morale is upbeat again. We're, you know, ready to do our mission, ready to do our job. We're the best at what we do.
Winter-like weather could affect major hubs, so officials say checking forecasts and arriving early may help reduce stress. Stocks across Asia closed mixed today. Japan's Nikkei average took a sharp dive, losing more than 1,100 points. Markets in China and Hong Kong closed higher. On Wall Street, Dow futures are up at this hour. This is NPR. Employees at Grand Canyon National Park are expected to file union paperwork with the National Labor Relations Board today. It's part of a larger move by workers in parks across the West to defend themselves against Trump administration cuts. Adrian Scabaland with member station KNAU reports.
Union organizers say the effort began when the Trump administration sought to fire hundreds of probationary park employees last spring. Organizer Michelle Vaught says they also hope to address issues like pay and housing.
I think a lot of us have put up with a lot for a long time just because we love our jobs. We love the park service, but we also want to be able to afford health care and afford our groceries.
Staff at Glacier, Rocky Mountain, and Grand Teton National Parks are also filing to unionize. It comes months after employees at Yosemite and Sequoia Kings National Parks moved forward with their own unions. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Flagstaff.
The executive editor of the Associated Press says the news organization is fighting for the right to report without being targeted by the White House. AP returns to court today in its case against the Trump administration. The lawsuit challenges a decision that blocked AP reporters from covering some presidential events, a move the government tied to AP's style choice to not call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. In an op-ed, the organization's executive director warned the case could set a broader precedent for press freedom. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
April 10th, 1972. Ken Dahlberg threw open the door of First Bank and Trust of Boca Raton, Florida, and slid $25,000 in cash across the counter. He'd like a cashier's check in that amount made out to him, he told the teller. Dahlberg, founder and CEO of a Minnesota hearing aid company, dutifully turned over the check to the Committee for the Re-election of the President, CREEP for short. The 54-year-old was CREEP's Midwest finance chairman, and he believed in Richard Nixon and wanted to see him re-elected that November. He was surprised, however, like most of America, 2 months later in June, when five burglars broke into the Democratic headquarters in the Watergate, and then shocked when a Washington Post reporter called him to say that his $25,000 cashier's check had been found in the bank account of one of the burglars. That little piece of paper was how Ken Dahlberg discovered that unwittingly he'd been tangled up in CREEP's money laundering operation to finance the Watergate scandal that would ultimately bring down Richard Nixon.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News, I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Many statements people have made about a peace plan for Russia and Ukraine sound familiar. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's optimistic. European leaders are skeptical and ask if the Americans are leaning toward Russia. President Trump complained that Ukraine has, quote, zero gratitude. We've heard things like this before. What is different is that they're responding to a 28-point peace plan the United States put on the table in recent days. In a moment, we hear views from Washington and from a German analyst. We begin with negotiations between the U.S. and Ukraine.
NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz has been reporting on this. He's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, Michelle.
So President Trump set a deadline of Thursday for Ukraine to agree to his 28-point plan. How are the Europeans feeling about this so far?
They are feeling left out. You know, even though the Europeans were present for some of the meetings in Geneva, when President Trump and his advisors drafted this peace plan, they did not consult European heads of state. And in Europe's view, that is a big oversight because the plan is filled with commitments that Europeans would have to make, like ponying up $100 billion for the reconstruction of Ukraine or being part of an emergency blueprint if the peace plan is violated. This is a war, after all, in Europe. You know, on the sidelines of the G20 summit in South Africa yesterday, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz had this to say to German broadcaster Deutsche Welle.
I think that it's not achievable to have all the 28 points agreed until Thursday. So we are trying to figure out which part of this plan could be achieved unanimously between the Europeans, the Americans, and Ukraine on the one side and the Russian on the other side.
Are there any parts of Trump's plan that the Europeans agree on?
Well, yeah, there's one part they agree on, that Ukraine must remain a sovereign state. But there are several points in the plan that the Europeans say are non-negotiable, starting with the idea that Ukraine should cede territory that it currently controls. European leaders have always held that the front line in the war has to be the starting point for negotiations. And the part of the plan that calls for Ukraine to reduce the size of its army, that is also a non-starter for the Europeans. Here's European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen on social media.
As a sovereign nation, There cannot be limitations on Ukraine's armed forces that would leave the country vulnerable to future attack and thereby also undermining European security.
So, Rob, where does this leave this peace process? I mean, are we looking at another, I don't know, stalemate?
Yeah, you know, the Kremlin still hasn't weighed in on the Geneva talks, and the U.S. says it'll hold separate talks with the Russians. We've got Turkey's president offering to mediate talks between Russia and Ukraine. We've also got French President Emmanuel Macron saying he'll meet with the leaders of Britain, Canada, and other nations. So there's been this flurry of diplomacy here. And from what we understand, Ukrainian and U.S. officials have already changed the working version of the 28-point plan from the original. But there is still a fair bit of confusion about that original 28-point proposal. A bipartisan group of senators said over the weekend that Rubio told them the Trump plan was essentially a wish list of the Russians. Now, the State Department and Rubio himself both denied that, but what is clear is that however this peace plan started, it is quickly evolving, and it is now at the center of a big debate here in Europe about how this war could and should end.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from Berlin. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Back here in Washington, D.C., many of Secretary of State Marco Rubio's former colleagues in Congress are voicing concerns over the initial version of that 28-point plan. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
The initial U.S. plan has Ukraine giving land over to Russia. It reduces its army by 30% and excludes Kyiv from NATO membership. Texas Republican Michael McCaul, the influential former chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, tells ABC News the deal leaves out serious security guarantees.
I would not advise Ukraine to sign this. They can't sign an agreement like the Budapest and then allow Russia to invade again.
In 1994, Ukraine signed the Budapest Memorandum, where it gave up its nuclear weapons in exchange for promised security. These guarantees didn't hold up, as seen with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Democrat Virginia Senator Mark Warner, vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, told Fox News the deal was historically bad.
End of the day, we all want to see peace, but we don't want to see a peace that rewards Vladimir Putin.
Over the weekend, Republican South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds criticized the deal and said it originated in Russia. Secretary of State Rubio denied this, saying it was authored by the U.S., but acknowledged it was, quote, based on input from the Russian side. But not all lawmakers oppose the peace plan. Republican Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri praised Trump's proposal on Fox News.
We live in a world of scarcity. The United States of America needs to refocus its attention in a much more meaningful way on the homeland, our hemisphere.
And here's Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky on CBS.
If they decide to re-up the subsidies and the gifts to Ukraine, I think you'll see a splintering and a fracturing of the movement that has supported the president.
In recent weeks, Trump has faced increased pressure from his right flank to refocus on domestic issues rather than foreign wars and visits. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Now let's turn to Wolfgang Ischinger. He previously served as Germany's ambassador to the United States and the UK, as well as Germany's deputy foreign minister. He now chairs the Munich Security Conference. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so we heard some American views there. Republican Michael McCaul says Ukraine can't possibly sign this deal. Democrat Mark Warner says it's a bad deal. Some Republicans support the president. But what's the European view?
Well, let me start by talking about the good news before we turn to the bad news.
Okay.
The good news is that we talk about a peace plan. Let's be clear. This war, if we don't find a way to end it in coming weeks or months, this war is likely to be just as long and as deadly as were World War I and World War II.
Wow. I think we may be losing the ambassador. We'll wait here a few seconds to find out if Wolfgang Ischinger comes back up on the line. And we mentioned he chairs the Munich Security Conference, and he's responding to a 28-point peace plan put forward by the United States. As we heard from our colleague Luke Garrett, some Republican lawmakers, as well as Democratic lawmakers, say that they believe this is a peace plan crafted by Russia, that this is a wish list for Russia. And nevertheless, we have a situation in which the United States is pushing it forward. Ambassador, I think we've got it back, got you back. And I believe that your point was that it's good at least that people are talking about peace. And you argued this could be as long as World War I or World War II. So that's the upside. What's the downside?
So it's good that we have a plan that we can discuss. What's bad, the downside, is that we have a divisive, negative, damaging public discussion about this so-called 28-point plan. Look, in diplomacy, sometimes if you talk about very complicated issues of war and peace, it's better to close the door and discuss these things with the Russians, with the Europeans, et cetera, behind closed doors before you have an open public debate. But my most important point, Steve, is the following. What I have been arguing for months now is that the United States and her European allies should do again what they did successfully in earlier times when we worked together to end wars and to create peace somewhere else, namely to start a meaningful contact group, mm-hmm. where we would be huddling behind closed doors, figuring out exactly what position the United States and Europe would propose, defend, and negotiate together. What we're seeing now over the last 48 hours is a rather chaotic discussion between officials in the public, etc. And I don't think that is really the best route towards peace in this very, very unfortunate situation.
Okay, so you're referring to what Rob Schmitz told us, that Europeans exactly. were not consulted before this plan came out. But now here we are, and there's an effort to adjust the plan somehow. I'd like to try to understand what a sensible basis for a ceasefire or a peace is. Would it make sense from a European standpoint, in some fashion, to just stop the battle lines where they are and everybody holds onto the territory they currently have, at least for the foreseeable future?
Well, Steve, that's exactly what we Europeans have been suggesting, have been demanding for a long time, namely to start with a ceasefire, stop the shooting, and then start the negotiating and the settling of the many, many issues, including legal issues, including financial issues, etc. It's almost impossible, and you cannot find good examples in history. If you try to end a war, if you have not stop the shooting at some point. So the most important and highest priority item is to agree a ceasefire and then take it from there. That's, I think, what we all need to try to achieve and understand.
And then the next question is about this $100 billion, which the United States says Europe would put up as part of this plan for Ukrainian rebuilding. Is that in the general area of what Europeans are willing to pay to rebuild Ukraine after a ceasefire?
Well, look, this is a little more complicated, but I'll try to make it very simple. There is, in the hands of European institutions and banks, Russian money, so-called frozen assets, that amount to far more than 100 billion euros or dollars, if you wish. The European plan is to use these Russian funds as collateral for a loan to Ukraine. So Europe is proposing that we would offer to Ukraine a very significant loan, and that is the exact opposite of the plan, of the item that's now in the 28-point plan.
Okay, we'll talk about this some more. Ambassador, thanks so much. This is NPR News.
Thank you.
I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
Station. And from Total Wine and More for gatherings and fall nights. Curbside pickup and delivery available in most areas. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR Archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera has a new life of sorts off-Broadway. The show ended its 35-year Broadway run in 2023. The new immersive version is called Masquerade. Jeff London explains this radical transformation of the popular musical.
Audiences for Masquerade get to hear a lot of the familiar score of The Phantom of the Opera as they walk all over the six floors of a former art supply store in Midtown Manhattan into rooms that have been converted into various parts of the Paris Opera House.
So we are sitting in what we call one of the plot rooms.
Diane Paulus is the director of Masquerade and worked for 3 years with composer Andrew Lloyd Webber to adapt a huge spectacle into a piece of intimate theater.
It's all decked out like a dressing room backstage at the Paris Opera with mirrors and makeup and dresses and props and wigs and toe shoes.
Groups of only 60 audience members gather to make their way from floor to floor, backstage, onstage, in the Phantom's lair, at a carnival on the roof, in what the production calls pulses. There are six shows a night with six different Phantoms and Christines.
There are 38 performers, and some of them do one show, some of them do all six shows. It's a very complicated matrix.
Sing once again with me, our strange duet.
If you've seen The Phantom of the Opera, you'll recognize much of the plot about a disfigured murderous genius and the singer he loves, though it's been sliced and diced and backstory added. What makes this really different is that it's happening just a few feet away from the audience. The night I went, the Phantom put his hand on my shoulder. Hugh Panero played the Phantom over 2,000 times on Broadway. He says after the first run-through of Masquerade, director Diane Paulus told him,
I love where you're going with this. I need you to do 80% less. And she was right, because I was still reaching across the footlight, and you don't have to. You can be subtle. What you did before with a hand gesture, you can do with a look.
I'm in this labyrinth where night is blind. The phantom of the opera is there.
Francesca Marotra, who plays the singer Christine to Panero's Phantom, says the intimacy of the performance is different from anything she's experienced before.
I had a moment the other night where Christine is feeling very unsure of what to do and anxious.
And I was singing to this audience member, and they looked back at me and just quietly mouthed, "I'm sorry." And I was like, oh my gosh, like, you just don't get to see that kind of reaction and feedback when you're on a proscenium stage.
Another way Masquerade differs from seeing a traditional show is that everyone in the audience wears a mask and is asked to dress up, says Diane Paulus.
We have a dress code at Masquerade, and it's black, white, and silver, cocktail or formal attire. I had no expectation that we would have, like, the gowns, the headdresses, the masks that people wear.
Paulus says composer Andrew Lloyd Webber was a willing partner in reimagining his best-known musical and having six casts do it simultaneously.
I did hear that Andrew loved puzzles, so that was my first clue that maybe he'd be up for this. Andrew and I worked on what would this new creation be and forming the script and the dramaturgy, and he was an incredible dramaturgical partner because he obviously knows the show so well.
But audiences who think they know the Phantom of the Opera are in for a surprise when they don their masks and attend Masquerade. They might even be asked to dance. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
So even if you get to go to an awesome play, the holidays can be stressful, except maybe for decorating, which research suggests can be downright therapeutic.
It increases our happiness and our excitement. And it also gives us a break from the day-to-day grind.
Psychotherapist Amy Morin says in some cases, decorating can even soothe other people's anxiety.
During the pandemic, for example, a lot of people felt better once they saw holiday decorations outside because it reminded them of simpler times in life. It reminded them that we're all in something together aside from just the pandemic.
Morning Edition producer Julie Deppenbrock went to a wreath-making workshop here in Washington last week.
I mean, I don't really know how to make a wreath, but I saw this workshop and I was like, you know what? I could really use a wreath on my door. It would be really nice.
Botanical artist R.J. Lucas leads the seasonal crafting workshops at St. Vincent Wine Bar, which sold out.
So clearly there's a lot of interest and desire for exactly this kind of vibe.
Wreath makers sipped on mulled wine while they gathered cedar branches, herbs, and flowers. The heat lamps were turned up outside to cut the chill in the garden. Shayna Wiseman said it was a new experience for her.
I get to hang out with my girlfriends. We get to see each other. It's a night away, like with just us. Instead of like sitting and drinking wine, we actually are making something, which is way more fun.
Megan Hickman used to make wreaths in elementary school, so she jumped at this opportunity.
I think it kind of goes back to like the origins of the winter holidays, of like bringing back the light and feeling like I need more brightness in my life.
Morin, the psychotherapist, says that brightness can radiate.
Just seeing that we're all doing something together, the reminder of traditions, can help a lot of people feel better. So you might not only be making your life a little better when you decorate, but you might be making your neighbors and other people in your neighborhood feel happier too.
Brightening the holidays with a little holly and a lot of cheer. This is NPR News.
Caring for a parent can be difficult, and for millennials, it comes with unique challenges.
A lot of us came of age and entered the workforce during major economic crises, and you add on the costs of caregiving, you know, that sets up an entirely different economic catastrophe.
I'm Juana Summers, millennial caregivers who are also trying to build their own lives on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered on KAXE starting at 4 o'clock today with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phonology, John Latimer, will look back at his nature notes for this date, November 24th. Weather today, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 40s. We do have a slight chance of rain this afternoon. Tonight, chance of rain, cloudy, lows in the mid-30s. And tomorrow, a mix of snow and rain possible, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 30s. Floodwood Business Community Partnership offers a Christmas shopping night this evening, 3 to 7 at the Floodwood Fair Center and local businesses. Visit with Santa from 5 to 6:30 at the event center. Also happening tonight, the Hibbing Spirit of Unity Parade starts at 6 o'clock on Howard Street. Great River Rescue in Bemidji is looking for donations for their upcoming online auction, which begins December 8th. Items like art, themed baskets, or gift cards may be dropped off this Saturday from 11 to 4. You can check KAXC.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota. With hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on community meals, add resources in your region by emailing news@kaxc.org. The Grand Rapids Centennial Rotary Club has a free Thanksgiving meal this Thursday from 11 to 1 at St. Joseph Catholic Church. If you would like your meal delivered, place your order by tomorrow by contacting Elder Circle. If you know of free Thanksgiving meals in your community, please send them along. Email psa@kaxc.org. Lights in the Pines is a drive-through holiday light display at the Itasca County Fairgrounds in Grand Rapids. Hours are 5 to 8 p.m., Fridays and Saturdays between Thanksgiving and Christmas. After seeing the lights, you may park and explore North Pole Junction inside the fair's commercial building.
On today's date, November 24th, 2009, Ed and Maggie Anderson from the Big Fork area report seeing a leopard frog today. Leopard frogs are not like the wood frogs, the tree frogs, the spring peepers, and the boreal chorus frogs who all winter in the leaf litter. The leopard frog winters in water, and it will find a lake or a pond. It will go to the bottom and sort of nestle itself into the mud a little bit, more just cover itself lightly with mud for camouflage probably, and then it will remain there through the winter, and it can obtain oxygen through its skin, so it doesn't need to come to the surface to breathe. It can get enough oxygen to stay alive, and the cold water sort of slows down its metabolism so that it doesn't need to eat and doesn't need to be active. So, unusually late for a leopard frog to be out and about, but as long as the lakes are still open and there's still open water available, I guess it won't be the end of this little fellow.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Over the weekend, Israel and Hamas both accused each other of violating the ceasefire agreement in Gaza.
The ceasefire is still officially in place, has been for a little over 6 weeks. Israel also struck a crowded suburb of Beirut, Lebanon, killing a commander of Hezbollah. This is the first Israeli strike in the Lebanese capital in more than 5 months and has many people asking about the nearly year-long ceasefire there.
To catch us up on both, we're joined now by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So let's start in Gaza. There were several Israeli strikes there over the weekend. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, on Saturday, Israel said that Hamas militants crossed the yellow line in Gaza, which is the dividing line between Israeli-controlled and Hamas-controlled territory right now. In response, Israel carried out a series of strikes across Gaza, which killed at least 20 people, according to health officials there. Hamas sent a delegation to Cairo yesterday to meet with mediators to discuss Israeli violations of the ceasefire. Israeli strikes have killed more than 300 Palestinians, including more than 60 children during this ceasefire. And Michelle, I know that sounds contradictory. We're talking about a ceasefire and there are still so many people being killed. As you said, both sides have accused each other of violations, but the agreement between the two is still holding and we have not seen a full return to war.
So, Kat, this ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas was put forward by President Trump. It's supposed to have several phases toward a lasting peace. Can you tell us where we are right now in that process?
Yeah, we've gotten through a lot of the first phase, which saw the return of all remaining living hostages to Israel in exchange for thousands of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. And most of the hostage bodies have also been returned. And that's where it's kind of stuck right now. The next phase is supposed to set up an international stabilization force in Gaza, see Hamas disarm and have Israel fully withdraw. I talked to Nimrod Novick. He's a fellow with the U.S.-based Israel Policy Forum, and he was also an advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Novick told me he's worried there's not a clear path forward in this agreement.
A lot of thought was given to phase one. A lot of thought was given to phase two. Very little thought was given to the transition between them.
There's still a lot of question marks hanging in the air. Who will make up that international stabilization force? How will it be trained? How will Hamas disarmament work? Meanwhile, that means the nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza still can't get a lot of the aid and assistance they desperately need.
Let's turn now to Lebanon, where Israel struck Beirut yesterday. What can you tell us about that?
This was an Israeli strike on a crowded residential area in Beirut. It killed a senior Hezbollah commander and also several other members, which the group confirmed. It also wounded dozens of civilians, including some children. Our colleague Jane Araf is in Beirut this morning. She's visiting the site of the strike. We'll hear more from her later today. This attack has raised fears that an all-out war could restart, despite a ceasefire that's been in effect for almost a year now. During that time, Israel has launched almost daily and deadly attacks in South Lebanon. This was its first strike in Beirut in months. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has refrained from striking Israel, but a Hezbollah official called this weekend's attack a new red line.
That is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Kat, thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is talking openly about trying to remove Venezuela's president from power, getting rid in some way of President Nicolas Maduro. The conversation comes on the 50th anniversary this month of a Senate committee report on the CIA's role in the assassination of foreign leaders, including several in Latin America. Turns out to be kind of relevant. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been digging into the history. Greg, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, it's called the Church Committee. If you cover intelligence agencies, national security for very long, you hear about the Church Committee. What was it?
Yeah, Steve, it's a name referring to Idaho Senator Frank Church, a Democrat who headed the bipartisan committee. It was established in 1975 after a series of reports, mostly in the New York Times, about the CIA's role in attempted or actual assassinations in the 1960s and 70s under both Democratic and Republican presidents. I spoke with Peter Kornbluh. He's with the National Security Archive, a private group that researches national security documents.
From 1947, when the CIA was officially created, all the way through to 1975, when the Church Committee reports began to be released, the CIA basically had no real oversight. The American public was unaware what was being done in its name, but clearly without its knowledge.
Until this report, which said what?
The committee gained access to the CIA documents and examined five cases where the spy agency was involved directly or indirectly in assassination plots. Three of the five were against left-wing leaders in Latin America, in Cuba, in Chile, and the Dominican Republic. Here's AP video footage of from Senator Church speaking when the report was released.
We regard the assassination plots as aberrations. The United States must not adopt the tactics of the enemy. Each time the means we use are wrong, our inner strength, the strength which makes us free, is lessened.
So several additional reports followed, and Senator Church went on to call the CIA a rogue elephant that was out of control, and it led to reforms still in place today.
Ah, well, if they're still in place today, how do they relate to this talk of getting rid of Maduro?
Yeah, really in several ways. First, back then, President Gerald Ford responded to the Church Committee with an executive order that barred the assassination of foreign leaders. Now, Steve, a large gray area has developed after the al-Qaeda attacks on 9/11. U.S. presidents maintain they can target individuals that are part of an active conflict with the U.S. Hmm. Most prominent example, of course, would be Osama bin Laden. But an executive order against assassination still stands. The Church Committee also led to the creation of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, which oversee the intel agencies. You know, however, members of Congress are complaining today that they're getting very little information on U.S. airstrikes against alleged drug smugglers in the Caribbean or possible military action against Venezuela.
Yeah, and we've been following the movement of an aircraft carrier and other ships into that region. I want to ask about another aspect of this history, though, Greg, because hasn't the United States, even before the CIA, had a long history of intervening against foreign governments, particularly in Latin America?
Yeah, absolutely true. Happened very often in the last century. Hasn't happened recently, but is a possible analogy. Some point to 1989 when the U.S. invaded Panama to arrest that country's president, Manuel Noriega. Noriega took refuge at the Vatican Embassy, and while he was there, the U.S. military waited him out and set up loudspeakers and blasted music. Memorably, it included Give It Up by Casey and the Sunshine Band, No More Mr. Nice Guy by Alice Cooper, and Paranoid by Black Sabbath. We don't know what the Trump administration is planning in Venezuela, but the president has acknowledged authorizing unspecified CIA activity.
And just to be clear, that old executive order did not forbid playing Casey and the Sunshine Band, so I guess that was within the laws, we understood it. Greg, thanks so much.
That's true, Steve. Thank you.
NPR's Greg Myrie. This is NPR News.
Brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
While Lava was climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather, I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
Good morning. It's 5:43. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. You can listen to our new Season Watch podcast with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. The Season Watch pod for the curious, it's filled with the delights of nature. This week, the delights of owl pellets. New episodes come out on Thursdays. Mostly cloudy today, slight chance of rain this afternoon, highs in the mid to upper 40s, and tonight chance of rain, cloudy, lows in the low to mid 30s, and tomorrow a mix of rain and snow likely, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 30s, breezy south wind. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. And the United Way of Bemidji's Holiday Gifts for Kids program is now accepting new unwrapped gifts for those aged newborn through 17. Donations may be dropped at several locations in Bemidji now until December 8th. Find more information and registration forms for families at unitedwaybemidji.org. The Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids presents A Very Good Christmas Carol. Free performances are this Friday at 7 and Saturday at 2. We continue now with Morning Edition here on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, in select theaters Wednesday, everywhere December 5th. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We recently followed a big, dumb debate over one aspect of inflation. Walmart cut the price of its annual Thanksgiving package. The Trump administration offered this as proof that inflation was down. Critics observed that Walmart also changed the items in the basket as well as the price. None of that really helped us to understand what's happening to the price of Thanksgiving, but luckily NPR's Scott Horsley went to the store to see for himself.
A dip in the cost of Thanksgiving food is good news for Kayla Jenkins. She's hosting 10 people for dinner this Thursday.
Only 10. I'm the oldest out of 8, so it's expected to have at least 7.
I met Jenkins outside a Giant supermarket where she was still planning her menu, especially the desserts.
I'm thinking I might make sweet potato pie, pumpkin pie, dinner rolls. I'm just really going to experiment.
Jenkins was pleasantly surprised by some of the prices she found inside the store.
They're not bad, honestly. It's really not bad. It's inflation, but it's not terrible compared to how it was earlier.
Grocery prices soared during the pandemic and the years that followed, and they're still climbing faster than many people would like, 2.7% for the 12 months ending in September. Cynthia Pearson grouses about her grocery bill as she loads bags into her trunk.
I just paid almost $80, and I don't even have meat.
Pearson is also shopping for Thanksgiving. She'll be hosting her 91-year-old mother, her son and his girlfriend, and an out-of-town visitor.
Okay, I'm looking at a ham, a turkey, maybe some salmon. Now, those are going to be the big-ticket items on my meal this year.
Turkey is typically the biggest expense on the Thanksgiving table, but according to the Farm Bureau, the price of whole frozen turkeys is down about 16% from this time last year. Food economist Michael Swanson of Wells Fargo says that's partly thanks to low prices for the corn and soybeans used to feed the birds.
What it tells us is that we have a mega surplus of food in this country. We've just done harvesting the largest corn and soybean crop ever.
An outbreak of bird flu did cause a spike in wholesale turkey prices this fall, but Swanson says big supermarkets locked in their prices with suppliers long before that. And many stores sell Thanksgiving turkeys at a deep discount, so long as shoppers also buy a cart full of other items. This Giant store is offering frozen birds for as little as 27 cents a pound.
Wow, absolutely wow. I mean, it costs a lot more than 20-some cents a pound to get that bird in the freezer.
Falling wheat prices have also led to lower costs for stuffing, dinner rolls, and pie crust. The sweet potatoes in that pie are likely to cost more this year, due in part to hurricane damage in North Carolina, where a lot of sweet potatoes are grown. Fresh veggie prices are also up in the Farm Bureau's tally, but cranberry prices are down. All told, the Farm Bureau says cooking a Thanksgiving feast should cost about 5% less than last year. Swanson says shoppers can often save by choosing store brand products instead of big national brands, but that price gap has narrowed in recent years as customers have become more cost conscious.
It's narrowed because the national brands are feeling the heat. It's really, really hard to convince people these days that the national brand is worth the premium.
Outside the supermarket, Cynthia Pearson points to some of the store brand items in her shopping cart.
I could go store brand because I'm usually going to doctor it up somehow, you know, put my own little touch and taste on it.
At a time when many people are uneasy about the economic outlook, Pearson says she's going to try to stretch this year's Thanksgiving meal as far as possible.
Thursday, Friday, it all should be gone by Sunday. You can't waste anything. This is not a year for that. You know, you have to factor in every penny.
Just be thankful our national holiday is not built around prime rib. Beef prices this year are up nearly 15%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Woo!
KAXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
What if you got to pick how taxpayer money gets spent?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, the Group of 20 summit has just wrapped up in South Africa. The U.S. wasn't there, with the Trump administration making claims South Africa persecutes its white minority. Economics is at the center of G20 discussions. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports on that.
The wealthier nations at the summit, like EU members, Russia and China, invited 20 smaller countries as guests. The G20 members signed a declaration meant to help them. The declaration urges development banks and international financial institutions to address recovery and reconstruction after disasters, along with disaster preparedness. It noted that more than 600 million Africans don't have access to electricity and supported efforts to triple renewable energy capacity globally. But the declaration is non-binding, and it doesn't say anything about creating a new panel on wealth inequality, which South Africa had called for. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
More than 31 million passengers are expected to fly for this week's holiday, an all-time high, using numbers from a trade association called Airlines for America. Some of that may be rebound from the recent government shutdown. The Automobile Association predicts 73 million are traveling by car for Thanksgiving. Marketplace's Carla Javier has more.
Many passengers set out on their Thanksgiving trips on Friday and may stay longer than they used to, says analyst Henry Hardevelt of Atmosphere Research Group.
It's a function of people flying on days where the airfares may be less expensive. And it also reflects that a lot of air travelers have the ability to work remotely.
He says consumers are feeling squeezed, so people who usually fly might decide they can't afford to this year.
I think that the people who are going to be getting on airplanes this Thanksgiving will reflect a much more well-to-do base of customers than we have seen in the past, even, by the way, if they're sitting in a standard coach seat.
The consulting firm Deloitte surveyed holiday travelers. Many said they are driving instead of flying in order to save money. That could be one of the reasons AAA estimates 1.3 million more people will road trip this Thanksgiving compared to last year. Aixa Diaz is with AAA.
Particularly if you have more than a couple of people in your family, already you're saving because gas prices are pretty cheap right now.
More drivers means more traffic, though, with tomorrow, Wednesday, and Sunday expected to be the busiest on the roads. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
And with remotely connected workers going early to avoid the Wednesday mess, the prediction is that return flights will make Sunday the very busiest at airports this year. Checking markets, Dow futures are down slightly. S&P futures are up 0.2%. NASDAQ futures right now are up 0.4%. Going into Thanksgiving week, S&P futures are up 12% in 2025. The NASDAQ is up 15% year to date.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
Here's a topic to enliven a Thanksgiving table. Ask everybody how they would like America to spend all the money it raises from taxes. We are not asked. Elected and non-elected officials decide at the national level, but locally, sometimes taxpayers are asked through a process called participatory budgeting, where residents have a say on paying for new speed bumps or for musical instruments for the local library to lend out. Direct democracy, but the track record is mixed. Cynthia Abrams of WPLN in Nashville reports.
At a neighborhood park in Nashville, the rubber ground is bouncy and makes for a soft landing when jumping off the towering clay structure. Both are new. And 10-year-old Jalesia Williams says they're an upgrade.
They got different materials that the park never have.
The park renovations were one of two dozen projects funded through Nashville's participatory budgeting process in 2023. Jalesia's mom, Janae, says she and her kids appreciate the improvements.
They love this park. We come very often.
But she didn't vote for them. Like most people in Nashville, Janae didn't even know participatory budgeting was a thing. The project started in select neighborhoods, and at first, city leaders were excited. So Nashville scaled it up, dedicating $10 million to projects citywide. But then engagement was really low.
It's just kind of like, okay, is this really participatory in the way that we're hoping it would be?
Mayor Freddie O'Connell points out that only 13,000 people voted, less than 2% of the city's population. That's even though the process was more open than regular elections. Undocumented residents, teenagers can cast ballots. So O'Connell phased out the process.
It seemed like we were asking people to do more work for things that they should be getting ordinarily anyway.
Plus, there's a concern that well-resourced neighborhoods might be able to scrounge up more votes for, say, pickleball courts, while communities in need can't get that same level of engagement. But supporters of participatory budgeting say it's really about changing the way government works.
It's a boot camp for democracy and helping folks to work together.
That's Dr. Selena Sue, an urban studies professor at the City University of New York. Sue says the very fact that Nashville's process is gone is evidence that it wasn't done right.
It wasn't big enough for people to really notice.
More dollars and better outreach are ways to make sure it does get noticed, Sue says. Participatory budgeting is active in cities like New York and Chicago, but in Nashville, it's gone. And many residents aren't even aware the process ever existed. In Nashville, I'm Cynthia Abrams for Marketplace.
And one more number before we go. $150 million. That's the amount of money pulled in by the second Wicked movie. That's an even 25% above Wicked 1's first weekend, with reviews ranging from great to mediocre. We'll see how that box office holds up. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd and on your smart speaker. We're People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. And then we'll hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Mostly cloudy today. We do have a slight chance for rain this afternoon. Highs in the mid to upper 40s. And tonight, chance of rain, cloudy, lows in the low to mid 30s. And tomorrow, a mix of rain and snow likely, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 30s, breezy south wind. Coming up at 7:20, it's events up north. Malachi Coons and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this